Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Charlie Ebinger, the director of Brookings Energy Security Initiative. And on behalf of Brookings and our co-hosts, the Institute for Environmental Security, Center for Naval Analysis, E3G, and the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, we are delighted to welcome you all here today. And I think the fact that we have such an incredible turnout suggests the importance and interest in this issue. I'm not going to take a lot of time since we have some very distinguished panelists here today, but I do think the event is timely with Copenhagen now just literally weeks away. There is, of course, growing concern around the world about not only climate change, but the resulting threats posed by droughts, floods, famine, and nearly every part of the world. I'll just share one very interesting anecdotal piece. Last week in China, the Brookings started the first of what's going to be a three-year series of events with our Chinese counterparts looking on opportunities for clean technology sharing. And it was quite revealing that in his opening remarks, the premier of China, for at least the first time that I've been aware he has said this, said that not only was climate change the top issue on China's international agenda, but in particularly with its bilateral relationships with its downstream neighbors. He highlighted this as an issue relating to water security, and I thought that was a very dramatic way for him to commence the proceedings. Without further ado, I would like to welcome our moderator for the first panel, Wouter Wenning, who will introduce the other panelists on his program.
Thank you very much, Charlie, and thank you, Brookings, for your hospitality, second time this year, and thank you all for coming and being here as our audience, and we hope for active participation from your side. I'm Wouter Wenning. I'm a chair and president of the Institute for Environmental Security with headquarters in The Hague, opposite the Peace Palace, which shows our interest in international agreements, international law as part of international security. It is well known that environmental degradation will cause, you know, food security problems, water security, energy security problems. But in Darfur, you see an example of how that also leads to violent conflict. This contributes to it. But it's also a national security issue where military people are involved in their thinking and maybe also in their doing. And we thank very much the CNA Corporation, or we appreciate their report of April 2007, which defined the climate change issues also as a national security issue. Now, as Institute for Environmental Security, we thought it a good idea to see whether we can globalize that message, because the CNA report is very much about United States national security, important as that is for the world, of course, as a whole. So we are very happy to have set up a military advisory council, which is chaired by Air Marshal A.K. Singh, and of which Joe Singh is also Major General Joe Singh from Guyana, South America, Caribbean, is a member. We have Chris King, who has become an old friend. He was at our Peace Palace conference in 2007. And we have Neil Morissetti, Admiral Morissetti, who is an extremely valuable member. He's a serving officer, one of the serving officers on the Military Advisory Council. And I'm very happy we have the three armed forces here. You know, we have the Army, we have the Air Force, and we have the Navy. Maybe we should have somebody on the space, but here in the United States, but, you know, so the armed forces are well represented. They will speak in the order they are on the program, so that doesn't say anything about the priority you should have to give to one of the elements of the armed forces. Now, what we thought was important, that from the military a statement would be issued or a declaration towards the negotiations on climate change, which are ongoing and which will have their have a very important moment in December in Copenhagen, the 15th conference of the parties. And they produced that statement, and you have that statement. You picked it up at the registration desk, I hope. And we will have a little expose or illustrative comments on the statement from the members of the panel sitting next to me. The statement, of course, is directed towards Copenhagen. Copenhagen is not the only arena in which climate change and security issues have to be discussed. Climate change very much is also a social-economic issue, so the G20 had to be involved. It's a security issue where maybe the Security Council could be involved. As Institute, we have a good rapport with NATO. We discuss issues about climate change and security with NATO in the framework of developing a new strategic concept, which will be adopted next year by NATO. And there are all kinds of regional arrangements which are important to discuss climate change and security. So Copenhagen is not the only venue to discuss it, but it's a very important venue because global leadership will meet there to show global commitment, especially to the issue of mitigation, who is going to reduce how much and at what cost. And that global commitment, therefore the theater is in Copenhagen. Maybe not the last time they come together, but it will be the first time for a real important stage for these kind of messages. And, of course, we are very much, we appreciate tremendously from a European perspective that the United States will be full on board also in Copenhagen. How far the domestic legislation has developed, has to be seen. But we are all looking forward to a firm commitment from the United States also in Copenhagen. I should stop here and let the panel speak. While Copenhagen will be very important for mitigation, adaptation also will be on the agenda, and that's also where a role of the military comes in, because they may see where adaptation is going to potentially lead to conflicts unless you take precautionary measures and unless mitigation is done in a successful way. I would like now very much to give the floor to the chair of the Military Advisory Council, A.K. Singh, and if you can be around 10 minutes, Air Marshal, that would be perfect, and you're free to say whatever you think would be illustrative of the first statement of the Military Advisory Council to the climate change theaters in the world.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This story began in this year when I launched the chapter at behest of our esteemed chairperson, Tom Spencer and Wouter Wiening in India on 15th of September. It so happened that it was a very auspicious day, and India was celebrating also the Ozone Day. So it became a dual launch as far as we were concerned, and I believe, and so does IES believe, that we were the pioneers of launching this Military Advisory Council, and also indicating that military advisory that there is a tie-up between climate change and national security. I also want to believe that because of this launch and because of all the publicity that we garnished out of this, the government of India took a note, and slowly but surely, the thought processes of the government of India and the Minister of Environment preceding Copenhagen started becoming more positive, and they started looking at the, I mean, if you looked at the statements made in the newspapers, they certainly were looking very positive, as against a large number of negative statements which were made earlier. Those were, of course, out of the India's position which it had taken in 2007 when Security Council, when UN wanted to project this matter in the Security Council, and a large number of countries were in denial because they did not want to securitize climate change. If you look at the first statement of the Military Advisory Council, which we hammered out between 11th and 12th of this month at Brussels. 8th to 11th, we had a session there wherein a large number of speakers were there, and Sherry Goodman, I don't see her here, she was one of the chairs there, and we had a very important session where it was spelt out in no uncertain terms that it is a national security issue, and eventually it will become a global security issue. Then 11th or 12th, we had a very hard taskmaster who kept us at it from 8 o'clock in the morning till about late night. And then we...
At the bar?
Then we brought out the first statement of the Military Advisory Council, which is in front of you. If you look at the beliefs, I'll start from there. At times, abrupt climate changes result in unprecedented scale of human misery, loss of biodiversity, damage to infrastructure, with consequential security implications that need to be addressed urgently. Who will address it urgently? Are the governments prepared to address the situation immediately? Would they then want the militaries to intervene? Would not certain conflict situations which are building up arise out of, which are building up because of climate change, result in conflicts? I, with some kind of authority, having lived there and having worked in the Indian Air Force for 40 years, can say with certainty that subcontinent is certainly facing a problem where there are more than one areas which are building towards a conflict situation. I can take you into the Indus Water Treaty, which has lasted from 1960 onwards between India and Pakistan. But this treaty, will it stand the test of time because of climate change? Glacial melt is reducing the flow of water available onto Indus. Increasing population in India and Pakistan, both, is resulting in overutilization of the water, or I would say utilization of the water in larger quantities. If the situation becomes harder than what it is today, then you will have many more hungry mouths to feed. It would become a national disaster for both the countries individually, and eventually it will lead to a conflict. Similarly, I take you to the third pole, which supplies about 10 rivers, out of which the most important for us is Brahmaputra, which gives water from Tibet to Nepal to India and eventually to Bangladesh. We are facing problems already, and the matter has been referred to UN bodies for arbitration. Whether you talk of Indus Water or you talk of the Farakka Dam, which is between India and Bangladesh. Now you look at the upper riparian state, which is Tibet, followed by India, followed by Bangladesh. If the flow of water reduces, the Bangladesh is going to turn around and say that India is stopping the water from flow. And one of the presentations which I heard last time, the gentleman who gave the presentation was extremely vituperic about it, that India was hampering growth of Bangladesh. It is not mere rhetoric. It is leading to a situation where eventually it will become a conflict area. Of course, there is, I don't want to steal the thunder of Tom when he's going to talk of glacial melt in the next session. You would hear about these rivers more and more. From this point, I would like to say that when I went to Copenhagen on 24th and 25th, I'd like to report here, speaking to the Global Legislators Forum. There were almost 40-plus countries represented there across the globe with all their members of parliament. So it was one huge parliament there of the world. And when I spoke about Military Advisory Council and the work done, and also when I highlighted the problems which will eventually occur and which may or will, I would say, in my words, it is will, but I'm sure the politicians will always use the word may, lead to a conflict situation. There was a vast amount of interest generated, and the session had to be extended by almost half an hour because the questions did not stop. It is not every day that the changes occur, but it certainly has become an issue which is now sort of steamballing out of control. If you see South Asia or Southeast Asia, in the last 30 years, we've had certain amount of storms and damages and typhoons, etc., which has cost us to the tune of about 32 billions in the last 3 years alone. The onset of these has doubled. Now, in the country which is as it is impoverished, or in the area which is totally impoverished, with large number of mouths to feed, because the populations are certainly huge. India alone has 1.2 billion or so. It is unimaginable for people in USA and Europe to understand those kind of populations, though of course the knowledgeable and those interested can understand those massive figures which need to be managed. There is no money, there is hunger, there is poverty, climate change reduces land, reduces productivity of the land. What is going to happen? Certain countries are likely to face an implosion within. It will cause an internal security problem. It will cause a problem of law and order. Outflow will impact on countries which are a little better off economically. We are already facing a situation of trans-border migration. If, let's say, for example, I cannot put timelines, but if, for example, about 20 to 25 million migrants moved in from Bangladesh into India, I'm sure most of you would dread to even think what would happen. India would certainly not be in any position to either feed them or accommodate them, whether you look at the land position or you look at the position of monies available for feeding them, caring for them, medical attention, so on and so forth. Will then it lead to a conflict? My personally thought is that yes, it may not lead to a direct conflict with Bangladesh, but it would certainly lead to a conflict situation which cannot be contained. So we need to train the militaries, we need to make the militaries understand that their requirement is also to look into these situations and prepare for them in terms of if a scenario takes place, how are they thinking of containing it? Will they be in a position to contain it, or whether it will spin out of control, and then which government out of any government of the world will have the courage to stand up and say that, okay, you start using force. I'm sure nobody will approve of bullets being fired on people who are unarmed and are destitutes. Do I still have time?
Maybe for a few lines.
Few lines? I'll just take you to second belief then. Failure to recognize the conflict and instability implications of climate change and to invest in a range of preventive and adaptive actions will be very costly in terms of destabilizing nations, causing human sufferings regarding development and providing required military response. The catchphrase here is required military response. What manner of military response would any one of you, if you were in power and part of the governance, answer this question? Because until and unless the militaries are involved from the very beginning in the policy, planning and execution of an operation, would certainly not take place in any safe manner. I have finished, sir, and I'm sure.
Thank you, Air Marshal, for stating the case behind the statement so very, very clearly. And I think you also made clear that if you talk about environmental security, you're not talking about securitizing the environment. You're pointing to the security implications in order to not have the military have to act, you know, in the way you were describing so vividly. So looking at the security implication of working back is probably one of the best manners not to securitize the environment, in the sense that the military have to solve the problematique. It's a great pleasure to give now the floor to the second panelist, Chris King, who has been with us for quite some time now. He will illustrate the situation which the Air Marshal already started to elucidate with the situation in Afghanistan, which, of course, is of great interest to us all. By the way, our time at this moment is limited, but we will have a question and answer session at the end, where you may want to pose questions, you know, to this panel. And then there will also be a situation where the military advisory people will be in a separate room down down the hall, where the press or people who want to interact bilaterally with them, you know, can be. So there is more opportunity to discuss, you know, things with them than right now at this very moment.
If Chris. I may interject, it is General Chris King. He's a military man, sir.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, sorry. I'm just a first lieutenant.
That's really the start of the story. I spent 33 years in the Army, but I also have an educational background in environmental sciences and environmental engineering, with a PhD in environmental engineering. Some people think that's making me a very confused person to have those conflicts. But what that really did was it led me to, about 15 years ago, a confluence of ideas of there are things, environmental issues, that if they're not dealt with, are going to become sources of conflict and destabilizing places in the world. And I started studying that as a research topic, primarily as I was moving into education from a full-time Army career. And there were several findings, and I'm going to share with you that as a preamble to getting around to the case study in Afghanistan. Obviously, Afghanistan has been chosen because it does have some dramatic effect, but it also has classic examples of environmental security studies and what we can learn from them. What I found out first in my study starting 15 years ago was this wasn't new. If you went into the literature, there were scholars that were developing. Environmental security is a discipline that had identified clearly there were more things to security than just the guns. Norman Myers, I think, put it best in this statement here in a classic seminal work on environmental security that he published in 1986. Notice even there, he talks about climate as one of the things he wanted to keynote, 1986. The second thing I noticed in my research is the military basically had paid no attention at all to that. There were some interesting implications of why that had come about, and it was a difference of two camps. And we still see those two camps. Those two camps are you securitizing an issue that really isn't a military issue in environmental? And the other is the military saying that's really not in our lane. And we continue to have those kind of discussions today. We'll talk more about that as we go through. Well, undaunted 15 years ago, the first thing I did was develop the 33rd definition of environmental security that I found in research. And to me, what it is, it's a process. It's a process that deals with the potentials caused by environmental degradation. My thesis basically is that it's not always just one, but it's usually the confluence of several environmental factors coming to bear in one place that will probably be the destabilizing effects. There may be one critical one, but the analysis needs to be done at a higher level. And I'll have to use this a little bit just to work you through before we can then understand the case study of Afghanistan. So bear with me just very quickly as we work through this. The theme that I'm going to talk about is it's a linked system. Without sustainable environmental conditions to provide for basic human needs, you have destabilizing effects in a society. And if those are not dealt with in some way, it becomes a security issue and then it becomes a defense issue. You can't delink all of these. They are basically intertwined, and that's what we're talking about. Now, what I want to emphasize is climate change is one of those environmental security issues, but it's not the only issue. There's clear analysis that says even if climate change doesn't have a significant impact, in many parts of the world, degradation of land, air, and water that are occurring at the rates they're occurring now are going to be destabilizing and major defense and security issue. So that's probably my biggest theme of this presentation is. The bad news is any impact in climate change in the populated domains makes it worse. So climate change is just more bad news in one way. Environmental security analysis is the common ground that defines the mutual interest between security and the environment. Very quickly to go through this. If you start collecting the data and analyzing the data, but not discreetly, but compiling that data geographically, georeferencing it, you start seeing places in the world that have common concerns, where water, land, air is being degraded at high rates, primarily driven by population growth. The hypothesis is if we pick the right environmental parameters and find a way to correlate that to stability and security, then we have a model that allows us to do analysis and to understand the security implications of that. And that's what I've been about for about 10 years, is doing that kind of analysis. That's another lecture for another time, but I need to emphasize that so I can show you the data on Afghanistan. So this is an example of one set of data that would be generated from this. But how do I verify that this model I'm going to build has any validity? Well, I'm an old modeler from groundwater days, and the first thing you have to do with the model is prove that it can produce the actual circumstances that exist today. So you compare it with a current data set. So what I've done is I've taken the failed states index, and I take these environmental parameters and I cross-correlate till I get strong correlations between those states that are failing and the environmental parameters that are going down or already highly degraded. If I can then get very, very strong correlations, it may have some predictive effects. And that's important in defense analysis. This is where the defense community and the others have not been able to talk. We need to have the ability to analyze the futures so we can make military plans and do evaluations of responses. What I did was I took the top 10 failed states and then I did environmental analysis on population, water, arable lands, rates of deforestation, rates of crop production. And what I find is it's very, very, very strong correlations, except for one state there. Now, I put France and U.S. there to show well-established developed countries that don't have those issues, just as a comparison. The only state that I don't get 95% plus correlation with is Iraq. And that's another discussion for another time. But that's the data sets there. What I'm going to do now is use Afghanistan as a case study. From an environmental security analyst standpoint, these are the data that I would collect on Afghanistan. Population growth rates, when the war started, third highest in the world. Fertility rate, eighth highest in the world. Any of the population statistics you would pick, it'd say the growth rates are extreme at that time. 13% have access to safe water. 21% had access to sanitation. In 1970, it had dropped to 12% by 2006 is when I did this analysis. For the rest of the stuff, 3% forest in the whole country. And if anybody's ever been there, I have had a tour in Afghanistan. Percent of arable land, less than 12%. Air quality, we don't know. There is no data on there. I know from 6 months in Kabul, it was the worst place I've ever been. Quick map here to show you in Orient. And what you notice is three-fourths of the country is dominated by very high mountains, but they're arid mountains. Tom Spencer is going to talk in a few minutes and talk about the impact of the ice and snow melt and the change of that whole ecosystem. So I'll leave that to him. But what we really see is all of the water and all of the land is generated from the high mountain setting. And any change to that is going to have tremendous impact throughout the whole populated part of the country. So now what I have done is I have taken the most conservative of the IPCC data set and I have analyzed that region of the world for its impact. We've already seen 1 to 2 degrees temperature rise in that area. We expect, in their conservative estimates, 4 degrees centigrade by 2090. The snow and ice melt in the Hindu Kush will be discussed later, but the impacts are extreme. Precipitation rates going down by 5% to 20% in an extreme arid environment already. Even greater changes, as Tom will explain, in the runoff, both the seasonality of it and the total quantities of runoff that will occur. We spend a lot of time in the IPC talking about adaptation and mitigation. If you examine it carefully, the adaptation and mitigation capability is zero. There is no response. They're already at the lowest sustainable level. And the overall vulnerability to climate change is the highest in the world. Two points here. One is the environmental security setting that we saw on the previous slide here. There's no definitive evidence, but clearly this impacts that society being able to sustain itself over the last 30 years, and it has certainly degraded over the last 30 years. The point being, these were some of the root problems associated with conflict in Afghanistan to begin with. It's not all just politics, but there is a basic thread of science under there, and that science is environmental security. The sustainability of that environment. The ecologists talk about carrying capacity. The second point is, in real world terms, the result of climate change in Afghanistan, even ignoring whatever military and political work goes on, still leaves us with the apocalyptic disease, drought, famine. As the predicted conditions, if we don't address those, as well as the military and the political solutions. We study and we develop our officers now to examine the comprehensive solutions, not just the winning the fight, but building the peace. Climate change, environmental security in many parts of the world, in fact, in most parts of the world, because more than two-thirds of the world lives at the lowest level of sustaining life, climate change and environmental security are primary things that you have to deal with in the planning, the strategic planning of building stable communities and sustainable environments. So I'll conclude. I think I better be out of here. I'll let you read those. I've emphasized first, peace isn't the absence of war. It's a sustainable environment. It's a sustainable condition to build on the other social structure. I actually talk about it in Life, Liberty, and Pursuit of Happiness when I talk about what in the world's worth fighting for. Go back to our history. What is worth fighting for? Life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. I believe those are still valid. That's just what Maslow said in the 50s. But I also believe they're hierarchical. Life first, then liberty, then the pursuit of happiness. And most of the world is still pursuing the life-sustaining conditions. Global climate change is probably the next immediate threat to that group of people in the world. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. I mean, General King. One of the reasons why we wanted to have a close association with the military also is their intellectual power. Military people, you know, they think it's scenarios. They know how to do modeling and to bring long-term projections, you know, to operational consequences and work back for the present situation to take decisions on. And that intellectual power, I think, was very well reflected in Chris's
That's more
presentation.
Kindness than I deserve.
Okay.
Real quickly, that slide I love, that's shows the absolute cultural illiteracy of understanding this, because the science is bad, the language is bad, yeah. Almost everything in there. Yeah. And the other thing I'd point out, that slide was drawn in 1984 in San Jose, California. And I think that puts us in a frame of reference of where we've gone and how far we've moved. Thank you.
Absolutely does. Now, the two other panel members, Admiral Morizetti and General Joe Singh, are asked to give their comments. They are more or less free to give the comments whatever way they want to do it. They may reflect upon what they just heard. Of course, we know all, everybody knows each other. And Admiral Neil, I'll give you the floor for your comments on in this panel.
Thank you, Walter. I'll keep this short. I could say it's allow more time for question and answers. I could also say it's although I don't disprove Walter's theory about intellectual thought in the military. But you've seen the statement. Why has the UK allowed a serving officer to sign this statement? And why are they paying some grossly overpaid Rear Admiral full-time to focus on this issue? Chris has talked about this degradation of the conditions in the air, land, the water, and climate. And the fact is, as we've heard from AK in Asia, but I've also witnessed in Africa as well, much of what was predicted in the Intergovernmental Panel Commission on Climate Change, their fourth assessment report, is happening much quicker and much earlier than we thought it was going to. And climate change doesn't recognise national boundaries. So it's not going to leave you alone. If you're doing something, you've got to engage in this, and you've got to engage in it globally. Clearly, we must demand and set challenging targets for Copenhagen. And that's in that statement. But as Walter has said, at the same time, we've got to look ahead and beyond that, because this just won't go away by getting an agreement at Copenhagen. And we need to factor this in. From a military perspective, we need to factor it into our military strategies, which should cascade from our national security strategies. It's got to become mainstream business. And we've got to understand that we will be engaged. This is not a military takeover. I hope you'd all agree the military forces around the world are, in the main, pretty busy at the moment, and there's enough on their plates. But the reality is we need to take some action now if we're going to mitigate for the future. But we've got to do it in a multi-agency context. In the UK, we've worked on stabilisation ops with three agencies, international aid, foreign affairs and defence. And I can assure you that is challenging. We're now going to look at about 12 departments, plus non-government agencies. And we've got to bring all of that together. So we've got to work together. We've got to understand what the issues are, and we've got to use a common language which enables us to communicate amongst ourselves. It's not all bad, though. There are some real opportunities here, not least in technical development. Here in America, where you pioneered the space program, we saw many benefits from it. More recently in the military world, perhaps we've done everything off the shelf where we can. I think we may be going back into another phase where that technical development that's happening in the military world, in order that we can operate in this world of the mid-21st century, will have benefits across all elements of society. There are three areas I think we need to work on now. An education process. Greater understanding what the issues are. In order that we can make informed judgments and we can manage risk effectively. We need to do research. And we need to understand our early warning systems to talk about these things we've heard about from AK and I've experienced as well. But we can do that on a multinational basis. And there are opportunities here for burden sharing, a greater understanding, and an ability to act now using the limited resources we have, and a recognition that the military do need to do this, and in doing it, we do not constrain our ability to conduct operations. Indeed, many ways, we improve our ability to conduct operations. The country that Chris has just been talking about in Afghanistan, a huge dependency on convoys to support our forward operating bases. Much of that convoy is bringing up diesel. Diesel to be used to keep the base open. We must learn from how to reduce that dependency. Some things are simple. In the UK, we've looked at how we can reconfigure our diesel generators, operate at a maximum load. Simple things that we've known for a long time. You do that, you reduce the number of convoys, the frequency, you're less vulnerable, there's less risk to life, and you're more effective. In the longer term, simulation synthetics. Using those for a lot of our training rather than live. We reduce our carbon emissions, but we're just effective in the way we do our business. So there's a lot there to be done. But I think the key thing is, it's something we've all got to become engaged with. It is more than environmental. If we don't act now, then the dangers are that the temperature rise will be beyond 2 degrees, and then it becomes, if at best, very expensive to resolve, and potentially beyond our ability to look after national security. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Neil, for also pointing to the practical spin-off if the military engages in technological innovation to reduce its footprint, its use of fossil fuels, which everybody will profit from. You pointed to the dependency, the operational dangers of the dependency on fossil fuels, how to bring that to the battlefield. You did not, but that may be for discussion, point to the problem the Navy has if sea level rises and Diego Garcia gets its feet wet and then the naval bases disappear, which also is a very important operational aspect of climate change and security. Major General Joe Singh is a very good old friend of mine. We are working together for 50 years, I think, in also keeping the tropical rainforest in the northern Amazon intact. Not only has a military, he has a military background, but also very much a conservation background. So he combines, environment and security in his own way in a very special manner. Joe, your comments, please.
Thank you very much, Chairman. Good afternoon, everyone. Colleagues, members of the Military Administrative Advisory Council, distinguished audience. I'd like to focus on three areas in terms of my comments. One is, why is it that a statement read by Air Marshal resonates with my part of the world? I don't profess to speak for all the countries, but I do have very good working knowledge of South America, the Caribbean, and further afield. Apart from my military assignments, I also had development assignments in other parts of the world, like East Africa, for example, both in the pre- and post-apartheid period, and good networking with the armies in the Amazon and in the Caribbean. What I'd like to say here is that we are a good example in our part of the world of the tensions between conservation and development. We have the highlands of the Andes, the receding glaciers. We have the rainforests of the Amazon and northern South America, and of course in other countries in Central America, in Mesoamerica. We have half of the world's biodiversity. The Amazon alone has one-fifth of the world's fresh water. All of the major rivers, the Amazon, the Orinoco, the Essequibo, discharge into the Caribbean on the doorstep of the United States, for example. And we also have serious issues of poverty. Some of it a legacy of colonial occupation and extraction of resources, all of which now are part of this dynamics of how do we interpret climate change and its impacts, particularly its security implications on the globe and on the population, the human populations. We have got currently our economy, let's say in my country, dependent almost exclusively on agriculture, logging, mining, extractive industries. We have 70% of our rainforest, which is intact, even though there's been logging for over 100 years because of the imposition of selective logging. But we also have the expectations of people, not only our plural society, but also of the First Peoples or indigenous peoples. We have nine tribes remaining in my country with links to both Venezuela, Suriname, and Brazil. And all of these people have expectations. What it is that the political leadership is doing that will bring them out of poverty or out of deprivation or marginalization? And what future do they have ahead of them? Politicians, unfortunately, tend to look for very easy answers, some of them very myopic, no disrespect intended, but that is the nature of the beast. And if there's a decision to be made between social unrest and people demonstrating on the streets and allocating logging concessions for extraction of timber or mining, then chances are they will go for the easy solution. Now, of course, with greater scrutiny, with remote sensing, with satellite imagery, it's very easy to see where dysfunctionality and management of ecosystems takes place. where indigenous rights are now on the forefront, and people can speak on their own traditional way of life and how development, as we see it, impacts on them and on their cultures and their traditions. So in the midst of this tension, we have the global occupation with climate change, with mitigation, with adaptation. Incidentally, we are 1 meter below sea level. The Dutch, in their wisdom as a colonial power, decided that they were going to populate the coast. So 70% of our population live on a 270-mile strip, which is 1 meter below sea level.
In the Netherlands, we live 9 meters below sea level.
So we thought this is a good thing to go 1 meter below sea level. That was very prudent thing we did. So, Joe, we'll...
So, I said, you know, the resonance that I mentioned is because many of us in our military careers had to deal face-to-face with the impacts of droughts, of fires, of disease, whether it's malaria, typhoid, dysentery, of heavy sedimentation in rivers because of mining, of land degradation because of logging, particularly on slopes, of overfishing and the impacts of marine pollution. Now we have, as you know, in the Caribbean, places like Belize, the damage being done to coral reefs and to the tourism industry, which is further affected because of recession and the flow of tourists coming to our part of the world has declined. So you have the expectations of people that have got to be met by their governments in a very transparent way, in accordance with the benchmarks for good governance. At the same time, you have the resources which are there, which provide a global good. And therefore, the stewardship of South America and the Caribbean, like in other countries, is measured against what are the best practices. But to do that, one needs to have resources. The military's role, as was stated earlier, is not to usurp the functions of the politicians. But in every case where we've had civil defense issues or social unrest, it is the military invariably that is seen as the answer to the problem. And what we are saying is, look, if we are reaching a tipping point or we are on the precipice of disaster, a scale of which is unimaginable, then it is only prudent for civilian administrations to recognize the role, the institutional memory, the capacity, and all the other attributes that the military can bring to bear, and to involve the military, and I use military in the broader sense, in a very proactive way, in an integral way, and not as a part of the periphery only to be activated when it becomes necessary, because that is cleaning up the mess. So in reinforcing what my colleagues have said, I am an advocate of the role of the military from a developmental standpoint. I tell people, I enlisted in the military not to make war, but to provide a peaceful environment, one in which people can realize their true potential, and where young people especially can look forward to a world where we, the adults, have exercised good stewardship in a collaborative way, not in a selfish, for whatever reason, manner, but recognizing the disaster which is unfolding, that we can pull ourselves back, but it calls for a collaborative approach, and the military does have a role to play in this, in terms of what we decide as next steps, whether it's in Copenhagen or post-Copenhagen. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joe, for also bringing the perspective of sustainable development into the climate change security equation, and for bringing, you know, the interface between the civil and the military sharper into focus. The area where Joe and I are working together, it's the Guiana Shield area. It's the northern Amazon. It's the three Guayanas, part of Venezuela, Colombia, and northern Brazil. It's 250 million hectares. And it's almost as big as the Tibetan Plateau and et cetera, which is also 250 million hectares. You know, it's a coincidence, but one is an area, the Tibetan Plateau, we'll hear from Tom about that, where climate change and security issues will play out in a dramatic way unless we know how to handle it, if we know that. And again, a shield tropical rainforest is still intact and is a factor in storing carbon, absorbing CO2 from the air. So it is a positive factor in the climate change security issue if it remains intact. And that requires sustainable development, and that requires, you know, an equitable sharing of resources, etc. Okay, we do have until 4:15 to pose questions to the distinguished members of the panel. I recognize a hand over there, and two over here, and I need to make sure that... One, two, three, four.
Could we ask that everyone identify themselves? Yes. And ask a question, please?
Yeah.
Hello, thank you for the wonderful presentations and keynotes. My name is Mishkat El-Mumin. I'm an adjunct professor at George Mason University. I'm also the former Minister of Environment of Iraq. My question was with regard to the Afghanistan case study. I understand that Kunar and Nuristan provinces are still active in terms of security. Part of the problem is the timber mafia is operating over there. Oftentimes, American soldiers are getting shot at because they got in the way between the mafia and the timber. Is this issue addressed as an environmental security issue or not?
Shall we assemble a few questions, which there's somebody in the back there, yeah? And then the two up front here, and then the panel will respond, okay?
Hello. I'm Helen Raffel at Resources for the Future. At Copenhagen, the greatest pressure is going to be on the two countries, China, and at Copenhagen, the greatest pressure is going to be on China and the United States, because we emit roughly the same amount of greenhouse gases, and the two together emit just a little less than 50% of the total emission in the world. Now, the United States, however, per capita emits a little over four times the amount per capita as China. So it seems to me that the most important thing for this excellent panel to do is to go down and talk to our congresspeople on Capitol Hill and tell them within the next few weeks to hurry up and pass an effective climate change piece of legislation so that we can go to Copenhagen in December and set the right example. Thank you.
Thank you. Two questions or two people here up front, and then there will be a response.
Thank you. Thanks for doing this. My name is Lisa Friedman. I'm a reporter for Climate Wire. And I guess to turn that into a question, your panel does come as the Senate is holding a series of hearings this week on the Senate version of the climate bill. And I'm hoping that any one of you can speak to what you hope this statement that the military advisors is issuing will send to Congress. And I'm also wondering if any of you are going to Copenhagen, will there be a presence of international military advisors making this statement in Copenhagen as well? Thanks.
Sure.
I'm Raghubir Goyal from India Global Asia today. My question is in India. How dangerous is this climate change as India's national security and also healthcare related issues are concerned? And Prime Minister of India is coming to Washington on November 24th. How U.S. and India can work on this issue, and what steps you think India should take now immediately, because there is also concern as far as climate change in China, also a next door neighbor.
Okay, thank you very much for these questions. I think the first question was to you, Chris. You please respond about Afghanistan and the timber mafia.
Well, there has to be a certain level of security before the next level of engagement can take place. And the bad guys know that. And that's what they try to avoid. And they try to keep that progress from occurring.
but we have to recognize what the ultimate goal is, and environmental security has to be built in the strategy that you're planning for, and then you can start doing this. There are many places in the country where we believe the best use of the military right now would be engaging with the people in planting trees and doing water resource projects. Because that's the next critical thing, is restoring a 1,000-year-old water management system that was wonderfully designed and engineered but destroyed in the last 50 years. And oh, by the way, that's been one of the jobs of militaries throughout the world, is the early developmental processes. But there is still the element of security to be able to do that work. It takes 1,000 people to do that work. It takes one guy to stop it or destroy it in many indications, if you're talking about a dam, a water resource project, or something like that. That will be continuing to be the challenge, is to get to the level of security. And that was the strategy, quite honestly, in Iraq, to try to get to that kind of level of security that you can still then start providing for basic human needs and show progress and demonstrate progress. We are behind that standard in Afghanistan right now.
Okay. Second question was about the need to approach the United States Senate. Now, yesterday, as it happened, there was a delegation of ours visiting the Hill and seeing the Senate staff, but I wasn't there. Were you there?
Yeah,
maybe you can answer that question then. Well,
your concerns are very right and live. And yesterday when we had a discussion in Senator John Perry's office, we had conveyed this in no unequivocal terms that this needs to be looked at. So I hope the message reaches the right quarters that you're talking about.
Can I add something to that?
Yep.
One of the reasons I'm here in America at the moment is to talk with the American Armed Forces and Department of Defense to share what is a common concern to both of us, to share our understanding, to share our experience, and I can show them what we've done in the UK and the UK military, and in this country, as any other country I'm visiting, I'm encouraging the military to discuss with the policymakers what the implications are from a security perspective, such that that gets factored into their considerations as they look to what they're going to take to the table at Copenhagen. At the end of the day, only this country can decide this country's position, or my country can decide my country's position for Copenhagen. But what we want to ensure is there is an informed debate in the process to achieving that position. And that there is a role for us, certainly.
One other comment.
Sure.
The process in the United States is very similar to many places in the world. The president, the executive departments establish the national security priorities and a national security strategy. And that will be published fairly soon. If climate change, environmental security, and those kinds of issues are there, then they have to be addressed as the military build the national military strategy and each of the elements decide how they're going to strategically look at what are the risks and opportunities in the future. Now, I will tell you, if you will read some of the most recent discussions and the vision, for example, my boss, who's General Casey, the Chief of Staff of the Army, he has already put these kinds of issues. Resource scarcity and climate change are in his 14-page statement of his vision of what the future defense and security concerns are for the United States. This represents significant progress, but it's not the end state. There's still a tremendous amount of work to be done. And it has to be the mutual agreement between our government, other governments, and then providing it a priority for the military to start reacting to those things. An interesting thing, the one common bond between everybody on that military council, you know, from a dozen different countries, it's not exactly where we've been, it's that every one of us have been involved in significant humanitarian operations in our military careers. Cleaning up the mess or reacting to natural disasters. So this isn't a new work for us in any way. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for those comments. will we be in Copenhagen? Yes, we will. We will have a common site event with Brookings. We don't know the exact date, but in principle we will have with E3G and with some others, Chatham House as well. So there, a delegation of our project will be to share that with the people attending the site event. I myself will be in the corridors from the beginning to the end, you know, to share this message with everybody who wants to listen. And if they don't want to listen, you know, then, you know, we'll use it.
That's what the military for. No,
yeah.
It's a joke. That was a joke.
And so we will be there. Then there was a question directed to you, A.K. Singh. I see also Brad Blackwell's finger, but let's first react you to the question about India.
Okay, how dangerous is climate change for India? There were three or four questions embedded in one, so I'll take them one by one. It is dangerous, as I had spoken with you, because subcontinent, when I talk of India, I talk of entire subcontinent, and if you want to be specific, then I talk of India as a nation state. It is very dangerous because for two reasons. One, we are a very heavily populated area. We cannot afford to have any climate change issues or climate change occurring to the nation, where today I was horrified when somebody gave me a piece of paper, research done in UK, which shows temperature rise of 4 degrees, and that is on average, and it shows India's temperature rise by 5 degrees. Now, if the temperature rose by even 2 degrees, the entire wheat-producing belt of India would be wiped out. What would happen? 1.2 billion is what I'm talking of. How will we feed them? So that is how much danger is being faced by India in terms of climate change. You're well aware of the floods, etc., out of season, which has already wiped out the entire paddy crop of South India. We this year will have to, I'm sure, import a large amount of rice and other food grains. Now, you look at another country, because the money supply is also limited. We certainly have a growth rate of about 7% this year, despite the slowdown. And as predicted, it may go up a little bit. But what we need to look at is that the amount of money is only available to us is a finite amount. So whether we are going to utilize it for feeding the masses, or we are going to look after the infrastructure, or we are going to look after development. So those are the dangers which are very real, which we are facing. India and China, then you asked the second question. Certainly the issues of India and China, which do not pertain to the climate change per se, is about border disputes. But the major problem that India will face is when, I'm sure when Tom Spencer does his talk, it would become amply clear about the glacial melt on the third pole. Now, when all the rivers which are coming out of Tibet are going to be, which supply India, unfortunately, when they are affected or the waters from those rivers are diverted, it would certainly become a point of conflict. Prime Minister's visit to USA next month, I'm sure these are the issues which will be discussed with the President Obama, because I really am not in any position to comment on that issue, but the Prime Minister is very much alive to the situation of climate change and also to the situation of the problems that India is facing because of climate change.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A last round of questions. I'm delighted to recognize Brent Blackwelder, former president of Friends of the Earth U.S., and my host in Washington, D.C. for more than 20 years. So it's my great pleasure to have you ask a question, Brent.
Right. Thank you. One of the three recommendations the Military Advisory Council offers is getting the militaries of the world to reduce their carbon footprint. I wonder if the panel could cite any encouraging signs, who is any military leading and doing some exciting things. Give us some examples of what's happening.
Okay. Other questions? Yeah, I see one. A little. Yep.
My name is Alexander Gritsinin. I am representing Global Environmental Governance Project. I'd like to thank you for thoughtful presentation and comments. And the question would be about the global environmental governance infrastructure and the military role in today's efforts. Since 1972, when the infrastructure has been emerging as something very effective and innovative, today it became largely inefficient, ineffective, and fragmented. What do you think be the role of the military in the coming 10 to 20 years? And how would you help improve effectiveness and efficiency to reduce adverse effects of miscommunication among different branches of environmental infrastructure?
Okay. Thank you for that question. I think in view of the time, we leave it at that. First question by Brad Blackwell about encouraging science to reduce the footprint or the bootprint, you know, as Sherry Goodman invented in a very nice way. Neil, you were speaking about, and I remember, if I may say so, that the UK defence also already operates within a carbon budget. That was a very striking information you gave in Brussels.
In the UK, UK military contributes about 1% of CO2 emissions within the UK itself, and the overall budget. And we have a carbon a climate change act. We've got to reduce our emissions by 80% by 2050 and about 34% by 2020. Now, to do that, every government department has been given a carbon budget to give its fiscal budget, and it's working on the basis of that 1%. We've got to find 1% of savings. So we are looking at how we drive ours down. A classic example is our defence estates, in other words, all our buildings, where we're already ahead of the target. I should indicate that carbon budgets is a very new area, and there's a lot of work going on exactly how these are going to be executed. But we are driving down our use of energy, as much as anything else, because of the need to cut down our bills. Yeah. And that's fine by me. If at the same time you reduce your emissions and you save money, it's a double plus, and you should encourage that. But we're also looking at it in the context of how we're procuring future equipment, that we're looking for sustainable procurement in the sense that what we're looking for is from a green audit trail. We've reduced emissions in the building of that capability, and the equipment has to have reduced emissions in its lifespan as well. And when you're talking about lifespans of 30, 40, 50 years for equipment, it's essential to do that. And again, we're working that through the department's processes, etc. So it's early days, but we've got a carbon budget to live within, and the senior civil servant in our Department of Defence has signed up personally to deliver it, so we're focused on it.
If I may add, in case of India, it is exactly the similar steps have been initiated, though no fixed quotas have been laid out for the reduction of carbon footprints. But the steps which have been initiated by Neil, have been indicated by Neil, are the steps which have already been initiated in Indian forces also.
Okay, now the second question was about how the military can contribute to better global environmental governance. That's a very broad question. If there are immediate reactions from the panel, please give them, but in view of the time, they have to be brief. And I propose that you think about that, or you think about it, and in the second instance, you know, we may come back to it, because it's a very elaborate topic.
Chris is
not yeah. Chris, no.
It'll be a surprise to people, but we kind of keep track of things, where people are and what's going on in the world. And it was as General Singh was talking about. We have the ability to gather information across very large areas in very, very, very good focus. And I think some of the strongest thing we can do is the ability to gather intelligence has equal opportunity to be applied in monitoring and assessing and keeping track of the resources. There's not a great deal of difference, and the technologies and the applications are really similar enough that could be where we're as further ahead than the open source or the civilian side would be. So I think that is the first thing we could bring, is have our technologies made available to go to that task. And we need to be doing that anyway if you believe that environmental security is really a defense issue, because we need to be monitoring that to know where the next generation of problems are and be about mitigating them before they get to be extreme. So I think that's the one I would highlight. It may not be all of it, but I think that's an important one to consider.
I think absolutely. Joe? Yeah, very briefly, Joe, because the next panel is waiting to start.
Very briefly, I would think that rather than creating new institutional structures, is to make those which are already in place work. And my own view is that at a regional level, if you have common issues, for example, as I mentioned in South America and the Caribbean, then there are existing institutional structures which perhaps do not have environment as an integral part of their agenda. And data sharing, utilizing that data, building scenarios, looking at contingency plans, integrating this with the civilian administration and the civilian population, in my view, are some of the initiatives that can be taken.
Let me just make one other caveat there is, we have made some tremendous strides in international relations because of environmental cooperations. This may be the opportunity that comes out of the chaos to build bridges in places that we don't get along on everything but can find agreements about. I have done probably more than 10 country-to-country engagements with people that our governments are still struggling to talk to each other about. But on environmental issues, we were able to engage, talk, and actually build cooperations. And that could be one of the wonderful things that comes out of this, is the world getting a little closer together because we're working towards a common goal.
Ladies and gentlemen, this panel will be a hard act to follow. I know Sherry Goodman and her panel will do a great job on that. So let's give this panel a big hand.
Ladies and gentlemen, if we could have your attention, please, to start the second panel. We unfortunately didn't have time to build in a formal coffee break into our presentation, but if you would take your seats, please.
Yep, okay. All right, everybody turn their cell phones off. I understand that's what the interference is. Okay, so it's a pleasure to be here with you all this afternoon. I think we have a very good panel. You've just heard from some very distinguished military leaders that I have personally been privileged to work with over a number of years, and they're doing some very excellent work that builds on work that a distinguished panel of U.S. military officers at the CNA Military Advisory Board has been doing for several years on national security and the threat of climate change. And this panel this afternoon, we have a very eclectic group of individuals here whose experience ranges across the various domains of the military, environment, climate change, and energy. And they will each, in their own way, be able to share with you some of their experience, unfortunately, I should say, over many decades now of working. Maybe you're an exception, Chad, the younger one among us.
At least one decade.
Okay. Working with or in the military or the U.S. Department of Defense or in the United Kingdom, in the case of Tom, and their experience as it relates to the subject we have today. So we're going to start first with, we're starting with you, Derwin, who is filling in for Steve Anderson, who recently retired from EPA and who for many years, along with Tom Morehouse here to my right, have been working on environment in the military with the U.S. Department of Defense, EPA, and in an international forum, working for everything from the Montreal Protocol to international compliance with standards when militaries are operating overseas, going way back even before the days of climate change focus. But bringing that forward to today, I think it's particularly important to understand how the military has both been a good steward of the environment and can contribute further in current times. So, Durwood, over to you.
Thank you. No one can take Steve Anderson's place, but I'll stand in for him today. And if you, let's see if I can tee this up. Do we have our? Guy here. Okay. So Steve Anderson, Cabin Hava Sarma, and I have been working for the last couple of years on a project that fits very well and has enlisted the military in it to help achieve the goals, and that's a fast action climate mitigation campaign. We start, first of all, by being very, very happy to be here with this great crowd. And to be working again with our friends in the military to be able to tap into their brain trust, their power, their organizational ability, and their prestige. They can carry a climate message into arenas that environmental folks can't always get to. And this is very, very important. Glad to hear you were up on the Hill yesterday, and I'm sure you saw a lot of the people who wouldn't let me in the door. So very, very good for that. I'll start off with some of the bad news. I mean, we heard from Chris King, the case study of Afghanistan, and that is indeed bad. But I'm going to give you some news that's even worse, because we're seeing, as some have said, faster climate impacts than have been predicted. There was a reference by Air Marshal Singh to the 4-degree study that came out of the Met UK office a few weeks ago. And this is a continuation of other work that shows that we are already in a very, very dangerous zone. 4 degrees global average warming is not 4 degrees for the entire world. India, we heard some numbers. The Arctic, that could be up to 15 degrees centigrade warming. That gets us into runaway feedback. I'll talk a little more about that. The impacts we're seeing and facing are of two kinds. They're the linear impacts where a little more warming gives us a little more bad impact, a little more harm. And then there are the nonlinear and irreversible abrupt climate changes. These are the ones where we will pass a temperature tipping point and not be able to go back, and will suffer irreversible and, in many cases, catastrophic climate impacts. We are very, very close to these, if not already in the middle, from the warming that's already been committed. The real uncertainty today is, when will we reach those points with the certainty that will require action from the political leaders? I've just worked with Steve Anderson and with Cabin Hava Sarma and with Nobel laureate Mario Molina, who's the lead author of a new study with us, as well as a couple of other authors, on reducing abrupt climate change risk using the Montreal Protocol and other regulatory actions to complement cuts in CO2 emissions. So this sets out the case. I'll talk a little bit more about that right now. We start with this probability distribution of committed warming as of 2005 emissions. The midpoint there is 2.4 degrees. This is based on conservative IPCC data. If you look at the fat tail extreme on the right, that shows that we have a probability, 5 to 10% probability, that we're committed to warming already of 4 to 5 degrees. Now, this is indeed bad news. This is comprised of what we can see, or the realized warming. It's about 0.8. The ocean lag of another 0.5, 0.6. And then the masked warming. So there's another 1 degree or more that is hidden by cooling sulfate aerosols. Now, this is very good for us to have this cooling amount, but we are aggressively reducing these aerosols around the world for public health purposes. So we're in the need of coordinating our local air pollution policy better with our climate policy, because as we do this fast reduction of the cooling sulfates, Professor Ramanathan, who's one of our co-authors, says we should be approaching this as we would defusing a thermonuclear device, because we will get exposed to the 1 degree of warming very, very quickly. And this, again, could push us past the tipping points. Now, this is a very rich graph, because the temperature distribution is overlaid with the predicted temperature tipping points. And you'll see the first one is the Arctic summer sea ice. We're well into the loss of the Arctic summer sea ice. And that is a shield for the world that reflects a tremendous amount of heat back into space. As we lose that, we reduce albedo, or the reflective ability. We get warmer, we get darker water underneath, it warms more quickly. And we start liberating the methane that's in the hydrates and in the what we used to call permafrost or permanent frost. And there's a lot more methane in that permafrost than there is in the CO2 in the atmosphere. So this could lead to runaway feedback. Geoengineers are saying, oh, that's not going to be a problem. We'll light the Arctic on fire, and we'll turn the methane into CO2. That won't be as bad. Okay? I mean, this is the apocalypse coming if we're not very, very careful. Okay, the next one, Tom will talk more about the Himalayan Hindu Kush Tibetan Plateau. Very important. We heard from Air Marshal Singh. The Greenland ice sheet, we know that that's going to give us 7 meters of sea level rise at some point. You'll pass a tipping point, and we won't get 7 meters of sea level rise immediately, but it will be inevitable in the next coming decades or somewhat longer. And then we heard about the Amazon, which we're counting on all the forests of the world to help us as sinks to suck up and store carbon. This is very important for us to get forest into the Copenhagen or post-Copenhagen agreement. Very, very important. But the forests of the world are all committed to dying off at 2.5 degrees of warming, and they'll shift from being a sink to a source. Canada's forests are already a bigger source than the transport sector. Rocky Mountain forests are dying off, Alaska forests, millions and millions of acres of old-growth forests, in this case because the bark beetle that's able to overwinter now. So we're turning a key sink into a source. This is very, very bad news, and another one of the feedbacks that's going to put us over the tipping points. Okay, so now the good news, there is good news here too. Okay, there's a lot of bad news, but the good news is that there is fast action that can be taken to reduce climate warming. And we tend to think of the climate problem largely in terms of CO2. That's understandable because it's 50% of the warming. It's the biggest piece. But cutting CO2, as absolutely critical as that is to do, will not produce cooling for at least 1,000 years. You know, this is pretty bad news when you're already into the danger zone of the tipping points. So you look to the other 50%. That's the fast 50, and it includes the black carbon Tom will talk about, HFCs, which I'll talk more about here, tropospheric ozone and methane. Those together are 50%, and they can produce a climate delay if we were to be aggressive in implementing strategies on this side of about 40 years delay. Very, very important when you're looking at those tipping points. And then we have biochar, carbon negative. Tom will tell us more about that, one of our favorite strategies. Okay, this can help us reduce disaster as the CO2 reductions, which are essential, ultimately kick in. I'll come back a little bit to the military's role in reducing the ozone-depleting substances under the Montreal Protocol, which has been a very, very important part of climate protection as well. So you look at the numbers. I mean, black carbon is up to 25% of the total climate forcing of the world. Tropospheric ozone, methane, HFC is about 10% each. Now, the good news, as I said, these are short-term forcers. So if you reduce them, you get a climate response very, very quickly. Montreal Protocol. The military has had a key role in the success of this treaty. And I want to tell you, if you don't know, that this is the best climate treaty the world has ever created. And again, the military had an important role to play here. And if you look at the far right graph, you'll see how much the Montreal Protocol has done for climate protection since it was went into effect. And that is 135 billion tons of CO2 equivalent, about 11 gigatons per year. And that compares the next graph here to what we're trying to get out of the next bar, what we're trying to get out of the clean development mechanism. Many of us really like the clean development mechanism because it's a development mechanism as well as climate protection. But it's a very small pipeline, 1.5 billion tons. Then you look at what we're trying to get out of Kyoto, 1 billion ton per year for the first 5-year period, 5 billion tons. That's very small. So Montreal is big and unbelievably successful. Let me skip right over to the far left bar because that's what's on the table today. There is a meeting next week in Port Ghalib, Egypt, where all the parties of the world who are, the Montreal Protocol is the only treaty that has every country as a party. They will meet in Port Ghalib, and then they meet for just two weeks a year, 1 week session in the summer, one in the fall. And they will be deciding on a proposal to regulate and phase down HFCs, or hydrofluorocarbons, to regulate and phase down their production and consumption. Montreal Protocol addresses climate upstream at the level of production and consumption. HFCs are in the Kyoto basket, but downstream emissions only. No one currently regulates the production and consumption. So we have a chance of getting about 170 billion tons of CO2 equivalent. This would be 10 years of climate delay, maybe 12. Very, very important for us. The U.S. has a proposal that they submitted jointly with Canada and with Mexico. And the first people to support this proposal in the interagency process were from the Department of Defense. And that's partly because Steve Anderson worked so carefully and so effectively with them. But they understood that this was something that was acceptable for them and the Department of Defense. They understood that for the 20-year history of the Montreal Protocol, they had had a cooperative relationship with EPA and with all the parties of the Montreal Protocol. They were willing to do this. And that led all the other agencies ultimately to agree. Okay, if we don't do this, we will end up with HFCs becoming the equivalent of about 45% of total climate emissions in 2050. That assumes that we do stabilize CO2 at 450 parts per million. If we bend the curve for CO2, we're successful there, we could still lose the climate fight if we don't also control the HFCs. Okay, so what has the military done for this? I mean, the military for ozone-depleting substances in the early days, and remember, ozone-depleting substances are very powerful climate gases. So when the military helped take out the ODS, they also contributed to climate protection. And the first thing they did was to help us change the specifications for procurement. And they said, we will work with the US EPA, we will work with the industry cooperative on ozone layer protection, and we will help find alternatives that we can substitute for the ozone depleting substances. That led, because the military's specs are the de facto specs for so much of the world's manufacturing and supply, that had a huge ripple effect over the years and helped make it easier to ratchet up the Montreal Protocol, which is a start and strengthen treaty. So I'll stop here, but I'd like to say again that I'm very, very proud to be with this distinguished group of military experts and to see them embracing climate change as a national security issue. And I would urge all of us to be thinking of the climate issue as not just national security, but in the same frame as we do a war that we need to win. We don't look at cost as the primary driver when security is at risk. And we have to start thinking of climate in this way as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Derwent. That was an excellent, excellent overview. I think we are going now to Tom Morehouse or Tom Spencer? Tom Spencer. Okay, Tom, we're going to go next to you, Tom, and we have the great privilege of having Tom, who formerly served in the European Parliament and has had a very distinguished career Britain and in Europe at the intersection of environment, politics, and national security. And is going to share with us an important case on glacial melt at the third pole. Thank you, Tom.
Sherry, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, all the previous panel kept saying Tom will speak about this and Tom will fix it, so thank you very much. All right, I'm not even going to attempt to do all the things you asked me to do in limited time. Let me explain that my military career stopped at the age of 18, and I'm a cadet captain retired in the Royal Naval Reserve. So I'm really here because I'm a resting politician, or a recovering politician. I spent 15 years in the European Parliament on the Trade Committee, on the Agriculture Committee, then on the Environment Committee, and my last job was as chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the late 90s. And so I was moved between different different issues, and I think that's an important an important idea, because so often we live in separate silos. We get locked into our own expertise, whether that's a scientist or politicians or defence. So for me, the issue of environmental security, which I took up with Wouter when I left Parliament in 1999, is all about integrating disciplines. And we hear a lot today about food security and energy security and climate security, and for me, environmental security is what ties them all together. Again, I don't want people to talk about energy policy without thinking of food policy. Biofuels is a good example of that. Or development policy. In India, they keep saying we have this huge need for development policy. We've got to keep investing in it. But if the kind of outcome that AK was talking about in the security implications of climate, that could destroy development policy, not just in India, but worldwide. This is the graph, much better explained by Durwood than I could do, but I just want to pick it up for two reasons. One, at the Institute, we've been pushing along these themes for the last, seems like an eternity, Wouter, but probably for the last 9 or so years. But we began to get a lot of interest from the intelligence and military community 3 years ago. And what I think was driving that was the recognition that abrupt climate change was with us. And abrupt climate change moved the nasty side of climate impacts on security from being out there sort of post-2050, which is the logic of the CNAS report and the age of consequences, to bringing it right forward into the relevant timetables of the military and of military and intelligence planners now. And I've also stolen the word squealing from an article in Nature in September, pointing out that when just before systems collapse, systems of all kind, they squeal. They move from extremes of heat to cold. Whatever the system is, you get this sudden sense of a system under huge stress. And I want to argue that our climate system globally is squealing, and actually our political system is squealing because we don't really know how to handle it. This is the guts of my story, and it's a map that I took from Munir Razaman, who can't be with us, from Bangladesh, who's in South Korea today, from a presentation he made at our conference in Brussels. Why look at glacial melt in the Hindu Kush, Himalaya, Tibet plateau? Well, one, it's the biggest issue of the lot. Two, it's visually and emotionally and intellectually powerful. And I teach, nowadays I teach for half of my time, I teach lobbying and decision-making and how to approach politicians. And I know that politicians don't, on the whole, cope with science. They deal with stories. And you have to give them a powerful story. It doesn't mean that a story isn't simple. Creating a story is something difficult and complex, because it has to be a story that holds up under cross-examination. So for me, the glacial melt of the third pole is a very powerful story. And it's a story when, and we'll see with the question of when the impacts kick in, it's a story that is in a sense a corrective to the belief that environmental security is very interesting, and it's about the behavior of Somali tribesmen in drought periods, or it's about will we need to raise the runway at Diego Garcia, or will we need more helicopters for emergency relief? It's all those, but it's much, much more beyond. So here is the map of Asia, showing the Hindu Kush, the Himalayas, the Tibetan plateau. I suspect in Europe, and I suspect here, that we view Asia from the coasts, because that's how we became aware of Asia. And yet the story of Asia is right there in the center, and this story is unfolding in the center of the continent. Those river valleys flow from the mountains, and they flow. This shows better than I can do by words why the Vietnamese are very concerned about the melting of the glaciers in the Tibetan plateau, because the key source of water for the Mekong is way upstream in the Tibetan plateau. Second thought: almost everyone looks at this story, and they look at one particular exercise. Understandably, India looks at what might happen in Pakistan or in Bangladesh, but people don't look north of the mountains. This is a very bad news for Central Asia and water and stability there. It's bad news for China. It's bad news if you, those of you who are security experts, look at any of the security problems in that area. They will all be exacerbated if we lose the summer meltwater from the glaciers. One of the problems with this is it's so damn big that nobody really wants to engage with it. And there's a second problem: it's so big, and we can't verify it. We can't put figures around it. For instance, we discovered that the IPCC figures on sea level rise do not include terrestrial ice, because they say we can't measure it. Well, I would much rather settle for a general assessment of what the problem looks like and leave detailed accuracy later, but to take it out of the whole problem because you can't measure it seems to me counterproductive and difficult. But what we know is that damn nearly a quarter of humanity depend and live in areas that depend on the summer meltwater from this area, the great rivers of Asia. First of all, what you get as the melting proceeds, and no one contests that the melting is happening. There are ways of slowing it down, but no one contests that it's happening. You can argue about when you'll have specific impact. What you get is first of all, you get more water in the system, and everyone's happy. And then you get too much more water in the form of flash floods. As the glaciers retreat, they leave lakes behind moraines, and then you get a sudden break, and you get a huge flash flood destroying infrastructure and damaging people. And the Chinese experts on this can point you to 20 of those in the last 15 years. But beyond that, you get to the state that really worries me, which is there are for any particular river, for any particular glacier, you come to a situation where there are no glaciers to feed summer melt into the rivers. The rivers will still flow in the winter. The rivers will still flow to some extent. And it varies river by river, basin by basin. But in all of these areas, the meltwater from the glaciers makes a key contribution to the level of the water in those rivers in the summer. You end up, if you build hydroelectric power, depending on a regular flow. You're going to have those damaged by the early floods, but secondly, you're just not going to have the water to run those systems. Step back a moment. This great snowfield, this great ice field, is the key regulator for the climate system in Asia. If you disrupt that, the kind of disruption we've seen to the Indian monsoon becomes really small beer. We do not know how the climate would work in an Asia without that great snow mass at the third pole. And if you really want to reach out and lose a sleepless night or two, talk to the geologists, because we had a meeting of them in London a couple of weeks ago at University College London. And they were saying, if you take this amount of snow and ice, the sheer weight of it off those mountains in what is, in geological terms, a moment, whether it's 30 years or 50 years, you strike up earthquakes. And Derwood was talking about the permafrost. Actually, there's a key area of permafrost in the Tibetan plateau. And so it's not just thermoprost in Siberia, and that's what keeps the whole ecosystem of the plateau running. Military implications. I can't think of anything less attractive than the problem of Western China being short of water. The stability of China has to be of huge concern to all of us. Secondly, the immediate impact on existing wars, upsets in Afghanistan and Pakistan. At an Aspen exercise yesterday, I was listening to the minister from Pakistan talking about the dependence of his country on the stability of water supply, but we know that that water supply via the Indus rising in Kashmir is already under threat. The General Air Marshal's already talked about the sheer scale of displacement or cross-border migration. And then we have proposals officially circulated, whether they'll proceed, I don't know, in China for the diversion of the Brahmaputra. I mean, the Air Marshal's already indicated that. I mean, these are huge issues which we need, in my view. For too long they've been discussed only behind the arras. They've not been put into discussions, and I think they need to be dealt with now. Now, of course, the question is when. I'm not really interested in the question of when all the glaciers have gone, because that's not the way nature happens. We'll lose some. It'll impact on some rivers. But the problem is, once it becomes apparent that it's happening, anyone in all the other river basins will worry, stroke, will panic. Now, you can, in a sense, as a politician, you can deal with this by denial for a bit. Not in my term of office. Ninto, much worse than NIMBY, not in my backyard. So we need to say to the political system, you can't walk away from this. You can slow this down, and there are policies that we can take to slow it down, but it's on course. And if you just leave it for an accidental outcome, don't be surprised if it doesn't leap up and bite you. There's one of Durwood's black carbon, one of Durban's fast action exercises. One of the things which is intensifying the melting of the glaciers is the depositing of soot on the snowfields, from the burning of domestic fuel in India, from the burning of forests in Indonesia, from the habit of the Chinese of not turning on their scrubbers in coal-powered stations. I'm going to go. There's another article. My final slide. Those of us who follow environmental security, you can see the milestones. You can see the messages. 4 years ago, Sao Paulo became within 18 days of running out of drinking water. I know what your definition of a security situation is, but I wouldn't like to be in Sao Paulo with no drinking water. Darfur, Katrina, the Peruvian glaciers. The glaciers in Peru are going to fail earlier than the Asian glaciers. It's already happening in Peru. Failing states and terrorism, the Arctic. Incidentally, the thing about the Arctic sea ice is it's one of the things which holds the Greenland glacier in place. And if you lose all the sea ice, yes, it may be a great commercial opportunity to find more fossil fuels, although I have to say more fossil fuels is something which humanity needs like a hole in the head at this particular moment. If you take away the sea ice, you increase the tendency of the Greenland glacier not just to melt but to slide. And it's when glaciers slide that you get abrupt climate change and suddenness. The good news, Durwood said you have to have some good news, Tom. So the good news is that this issue has to some extent come out of the silo, come out of the closet. The Secretary General's report from the General Assembly in June, produced in September, my goodness, the UN at high speed, has legitimized the discussion of this issue. I'm going to leave it there. There is, I hope, enough there for all of you to bite on and to take this forward. If you want more information, it's all on the IAS website at www.envirosecurity.org. We respect absolutely Brookings' confidentiality exercises, but if you want to stay in touch with us on this project, Andrew Alder, who was calling you all to order earlier, is the chairman of IAS North America. Hand him your card on the way out, and we'll make sure that you stay involved in this. Thank you very much.
Tom, thank you very much for that excellent presentation. We're going to turn now to Chad Briggs, who is filling in for Carol DeMaine from the Department of Energy, who could not be here with us today. Carol is the Deputy Director for Energy and Environmental Security in the Office of Intelligence and Counterintelligence at the U.S. Department of Energy, which is a new and important position at DOE as it integrates environment, climate change, energy into its portfolio. And Chad will be an excellent representative of that office. Thank you, Chad.
Thank you, Sherry. Thank all of you for coming today. And I should say that it's easier coming towards the end of so many good presentations, because then there's very little left that I really have to say. Carol DeMaine sends her apologies, but I was asked to speak in her stead. I should point out, however, I'm not speaking on behalf of the U.S. government, but rather as a representative and a researcher who's working in new efforts not simply to discuss the policy options, but rather to look at the opposite end, to look at how we can find early warning capabilities and develop a strategic intelligence capability for not only the U.S. government, but for the international community. Now, there are four points that I'd first like to make, and some of these have already been mentioned before. First, and this echoes what General King had mentioned earlier, these are very complex systems, and these are very complex problems. These are not simple security issues regarding one uniformed army fighting against another, but rather we're discussing the systems that underlie the very stability of economic, social, and political stability within many parts of the world. Furthermore, these are not issues in which the most obvious risks are the ones that we have to worry about the most. The classical definition of a surprise attack by the military, going back to literature on Pearl Harbor, but also 9/11, is that it's those things which we understand the least and which we expect the least, which are most likely to be the biggest threats to us. Now, in order to address this, then, to go on to the second point, we have to look in the dark. That is, we can't simply focus on the things that we understand the best, but we have to develop scenarios and capabilities to look into those places and address the things that we understand the least. We have to understand, why are there holes in the science? Why are there things that we haven't explored yet? And what are the impacts, especially on regional and local levels, which will affect us, but maybe indirect effects, maybe things that are effects that are second order, that we are exhibited simply by feedback effects, but not simply first order effects. Those are the things that we have to explore, not in terms of predicting what will happen, but in terms of producing really vivid scenarios to allow policymakers in the military to explore what are the things that may happen in the future, what are the things that you may have to be prepared for. Because it's by expanding that sort of imagination, which was first started in the 2003 report by Schwartz and Randall in talking about abrupt climate changes, but to bring really up-to-date science and translate that in a way that can be brought to bear by people not just in Washington but in international capitals. Now, third, however, and this was, I think, mentioned by Admiral Morissetti earlier, it requires that we have to work outside of our normal silos. We have to cross boundaries, both politically, bureaucratically, and in terms of our disciplinary boundaries. No one area of study is going to understand fully how things are going to work and what areas in these complex systems are most vulnerable to instabilities. And it's identification of those critical vulnerable nodes that we have to identify in advance so that we can adapt, that we can have policies that will shore them up, that will make them more resilient, and so that we're not simply cleaning up afterwards with what will happen in terms of irreversible energy and environmental insecurity problems. But in order to provide these partnerships, we have to work across political boundaries that normally had been considered, well, inviolate in terms of security cases. In our own experiences, we've been working with partnerships, say, in Germany, Britain, Sweden. I'm off to Australia next week for most of the month. In order to find the experts, the people who really understand these issues, who can translate what these global issues are and what they mean for people at local levels, so that these can then be communicated to policymakers in terms of a risk management framework. What are the things that really matter to the people at local levels? Because you can't simply go to policymakers and say there's a 2-degree or 4-degree average climate change that's going to occur. As Tom Spencer said, you have to create stories, but the stories have to be locally meaningful as well. And fourth, this also requires that we have transparency. In order to really cooperate with people, not just in government, but outside of government, non-governmental organizations, scientists, the people who really have all of this information. You have to create a culture of trust, long-term trust, which is, again, not something which was typically focused on or viewed as something terribly important in traditional security matters, at least not in terms of outside communities. But it's this establishment of trust, the cooperation, this idea that we can all work together, that we have these cooperative and global security issues that we have to address not just as nation states, but really as a global commons. And it's these sorts of issues that this program, known as GlobalEase, is meant to address. What it is a bottom-up approach in which we collect different experts, not simply from the traditional intelligence community, but from outside that community as well. Academics, people from non-governmental organizations, from business, people who really have the expertise and are willing to give something to that community. What we already have is an online system which is currently being developed and is currently in use. And many of the assessments that we're already developing, there's one on abrupt climate change which should be due out in about another month. And this is the start of new scenario processes by which we can come up with emergent ideas and emergent knowledge about what are the things that we should worry about the most. Many times in planning, we focus on those things that we think we understand the best. But again, in terms of planning, we need to look in the dark. We need to look at those things that the experts will say, hey, I think, actually, we're not looking at here closely enough. And so instead, let's look at glacial models. Let's look at why we didn't understand the rapid melt of the Greenland ice sheet. And let's look at what this actually means in terms of cascading effects for global sea level rise, for changes in albedo, for changes in, say, the thermohaline ocean circulation, and what then that would mean for ecological effects, what communities rely upon those ecosystems, and then how that comes back to affect us even here in Washington. And so just to really quickly conclude, the Global Foresight Commons is meant to be a way to sort of visualize and communicate these early warning signals, these instabilities that Tom Spencer meant in terms of squealing, these sort of weak signals that we can then take as experts and amplify. And it's this sort of collective intelligence capability that we need to really cultivate and that we need to then communicate to people in saying, not just these are problems, but this is why these are problems, and these are some of the risks that we have to understand. And so just to conclude, I'd like to emphasize that when we talk about risks, oftentimes we make the mistake of thinking that risk is simply a measure of impact times probability. But we forget the third measure is uncertainty, and that the higher the uncertainty is, the higher the error bars go, then the more of a risk it actually is. And it's the need for finding these negative reports of people reporting, we don't understand this yet. There's high uncertainty here. So therefore, this is more of a risk than we thought it was earlier. And with that, I'll thank you and turn it over to Sherry again.
Thank you, Chad. That was very, very well said. We're going to turn to Tom Morehouse for our last commentary. Tom will give you the last word on this panel. Tom and I have worked together for over a decade and a half when Tom as an active duty Air Force officer and I were together in the Pentagon in running the Environmental Security Office at DOD at that time. And Tom has so much experience working at the cross-section of all these issues in the military environment and energy, and was the principal author of the Defense Science Board report on energy in 2008, and has been part of both CNA reports on national security and the threat of climate change, as well as powering America's defense, energy, and the risk to national security. Tom.
Thank you, Sherry. So far, most of the panelists have spoken about DOD in the capacity of being... Oh, thank you. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. Most of my colleagues here on the panel have spoken so far about DOD in the role of being a respondent, if you will, to the security consequences resulting from climate change. I'd like to take off on something Durwood alluded to earlier, which was the role that the Defense Department played in the Montreal Protocol, and that is the role that the Defense Department can play in a adaptation and mitigation role for climate change. So Maybe we can end on a little happy, optimistic note here. It's important to recognize what the primary mission of the Defense Department or the militaries are, and that is to possess the capability to execute military combat operations, if you will. And so all of the expenditures that DoD makes are aimed in that direction. Now, having said that, a lot of the things, if you will, that the DoD needs to own and needs to maintain in order to accomplish that mission have strong analogs in the private sector. They have installations, which are much like municipalities. They have transportation systems, air, ground, and sea, which are analogous in many ways to things operated by the private sector. There are big land managers. The U.S. DoD, for example, manages about 30 million acres of land, and land has effect on carbon as well. So a lot of the activities that take place in the private sector that contribute to climate change have these strong analogs in the military. So we look at where is there an alignment of interests, if you will. And using the Montreal Protocol as an example, at the time that the Montreal Protocol was signed in 1987 and came into effect in 1989, every system that the military owned, every system in the inventory, used these chemicals for either its manufacture, its maintenance, or its operation. So the need to resolve this issue, if you will, was key to preserving DoD's, the military's, operational capabilities. And so there was a full-court press, if you will, to find similar users in the private sector, to partner with them, to develop the technical solutions, and to move those beyond the laboratory stage, if you will, and to put those into practice. And what we see happening in the defense establishment today, at least in the U.S., is a similar recognition of this commonality, if you will, between the need to constrain our carbon emissions and the need to maintain our military operability. Let me explain for a second how that has occurred and why that's important. One of the most important or key risks, if you will, facing the Defense Department when it comes to energy is the ability to move energy from where we need it to where we use it. Someone alluded earlier in the first panel to Afghanistan and the large amount of energy, fuel, if you will, that we have to move from outside Afghanistan into Afghanistan through very treacherous terrain. If you look at the changing nature of conflict over the past couple of decades, we see some trend lines that move the Defense Department in this direction. Conflicts are becoming longer. Our operations are becoming more energy intense. That means the logistics tail that we need to support that is becoming larger, a larger target as well for the bad guys. The bad guys are becoming more capable. Asymmetric threats, commercial technology enabling non-state actors to deploy very lethal and effective capabilities, if you will. So our log tail is getting bigger, the lines of communication are getting longer, the conflicts are getting longer, and the bad guys are getting better at attacking the things that we need in order to sustain our operation. So what's the answer to that problem from a military capability standpoint? Well, the answer is figuring out how to be able to prosecute your missions on much less fuel. And so this remedy, if you will, this category of remedies is much like the category of remedies that the private sector needs. I think of DoD as kind of being the high-value user, if you will, of new energy technologies, both in terms of alternative forms of energy and in terms of technologies that allow us to improve our energy productivity. There's a similar situation, if you will, at the installations. Our fixed installations, our municipalities, if you will, are becoming ever more critical pieces of our ability to convey military capabilities. Instantaneous international secure communication means that we have operations in the United States now that are more real-time relevant to the kinds of operations we have going on overseas. These critical missions use a lot of power. The power requirements are getting larger. At the same time, the grid has become a bit less resilient, if you will. And so it's becoming incumbent on the military to be able to assure that they've got power suitable to maintain these missions for long duration in the event the grid goes out. So the DoD is investing in technologies, if you will, that help them assure continuity of mission. That means much higher levels of efficiency, renewable energy sources, and the ability to interact these loads and supplies using smart grid technology as well. What the president talked about the other day that we need nationally. So in many ways, DoD is a microcosm, if you will, of many of the remedies that we need nationally. So the last piece of this, I guess, is adaptation of infrastructure. DOD owns an awful lot of infrastructure, and many of our installations are coastal. So DOD is thinking now about how do we anticipate the effects of climate change, and how do we change the standards to which we build our infrastructure so that we can either withstand the effects of climate change or move these facilities, if you will, into places where they are more survivable. As the Defense Department starts thinking about this and starts investing in this, other people are likely to as well. So I think DOD plays some important roles in a couple of ways. First is, as Tom Friedman likes to talk about, the energy technology catalyst, if you will, making the investments to find the technical solutions. And then those solutions can be harvested by the commercial marketplace. The second is as a model. As DOD begins to roll these things out and learns how to move these technologies from the laboratory, from the pilot scale, into a full-scale application, the private sector learns from those lessons. And then the third is a testbed. Because of the commonality of DOD, many of its elements, if you will, to what happens in the private sector, DOD becomes a logical place to test things, whether it's something coming out of the Department of Energy or some other federal agency or a national lab or the private sector. DOD can become a way of validating, testing, providing market confidence in some of these solutions. This model has worked well in the Montreal Protocol. I think this model can work well for the kinds of technologies that we need to address climate change. And this is starting to happen. In 2009, the Congress passed a law, the National Defense Authorization Act, and which it required the Defense Department to begin embedding energy considerations into its planning process. This planning process drives investment because the planning process dictates what kind of systems we'll buy in the future and what kind of technologies that there will be in those systems. Now, if your planning assumptions are that energy is not a problem, that will always be available, it will always be free, it will always be or cheap, it will always be secure, then you don't tend to invest in these kinds of things. But if you start changing your planning assumptions and you start recognizing that energy is not going to be cheap, it's not going to be secure, and it's not going to be abundant, you start thinking differently about the importance of minimizing the amount of energy that you need in order to deploy your capabilities and finding alternative energy sources. And this is the direction the Defense Department is going, and I think that you're going to see some exciting things coming out of DOD over the next year or two. So with that, Sherry, I'd like to turn it over to questions.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, we have 6 or 7 minutes for questions. Okay. In the back, please.
Hi, my name is Caitlin. I'm with Avoided Deforestation Partners, and my question is for Durwood. It seemed in the Fast Action Plan that deforestation wasn't a part of that, and it's a contributor to about 17% greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere and clearly a security issue with land. I was wondering if it was not included, and if so, why not? Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, in fact, in the article that I put up there, it is included biosequestration and the biochar component as well, which is a way of taking biomass, pyrolysizing it, putting it back into a stable form of carbon that can be sequestered for hundreds to thousands of years. So it's a very important process for us to get to the military to validate and test and then drive the market. But yes, the forests are in there. The caveat is one that I'll repeat. We're just about to kill all the forest with the committed warming. So we have to go backwards quickly, and we have to move to carbon negative, which is a new frame that all of us need to be thinking about, carbon negative. So biochar is one such technology. There's carbon negative cement already being produced in California. There are new technologies out there that are even more promising than many of the ones that we often think might save us.
Yes, let's take these two questions. Yes, woman here and then gentleman in the front.
I have a question about the connection between environmental policies and insurgency. I wonder if the Office of for Intelligence and Counterintelligence has examined that. especially in a post-conflict setting. So sometimes there is, actually most of the times, there is a chance that the military can face insurgency because of environmental policies that the host nation enacted. I wonder if that aspect has been examined. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Gentleman right here.
I'm Fred Altman, and my question is on developing better or more effective communication about environmental issues. To get support, you need to get the population behind you. And there are a lot of people who are more concerned about short-term costs and resistant to the message. Maybe Senator Inhofe might be a prime example. Any answers to that?
Okay. Chad, will you take the first question? And
we can all chip into the next one. Sorry. Yeah, in terms of insurgency, I actually came to the Department of Energy after working for a long time in post-conflict reconstruction. And a lot of the issues really kind of hold together. We're not looking specifically right now in terms of post-war areas, just because of the emphasis of what we'd like to do. But there's no reason why those sorts of considerations couldn't be taken into account. The whole issue of post-conflict resource management, and I'm still doing research in that area, is, of course, extremely important because so much of what underlies legitimacy for a government, especially a nascent government or one that's recovering from conflict, is linked to the provision of basic environmental services. And there are people, for example, at the Army Environmental Policy Institute, people like Stephen Hearn, who've done studies, or at least reported on studies, indicating that, say, in Sadr City in Baghdad, they indicated that once basic provisions of, say, water and electricity have been provided, then the insurgency in those areas went down. And of course, that's just a correlation, but it makes sense that once you can provide really basic resources and availability of resources, and my Swedish colleagues who are doing work in Sudan and Darfur had said basically the same thing, that if you provide livelihoods for people, and in an equitable way, in a way that reflects properly upon the government that is meant to be supporting them, then it's less likely that they'll resort to violence in order to settle their claims.
Thank you.
Yes, communications question.
Mm-hmm.
The how do we carry public opinion with us? Two anecdotes, if I may. I've done a lot of work with the churches on this issue, particularly with the head of the Orthodox Church, Patriarch Bartholomaeus, the Patriarch of Constantinople, who's promoted a series of floating symposia, religion, science, and environment, the latest of which was on the Mississippi and ended up in New Orleans. And when you're discussing, I mean, he asked me to give a lecture to his theological school about 10 years ago, which is, how do you communicate something as catastrophic as this without producing a sense of freezing, that people just fear it so much they go straight into denial. And so that's the overall frame of it. Secondly, we all listen to messages with our own value system. So one of the reasons for the symposium going from Memphis down to New Orleans was to talk more openly with the evangelical churches about how they saw climate change. And that actually takes you straight back to the interpretation of the book of Revelation. And so if you're communicating, you need to do so with empathy and understanding how people are listening. And Jim Bohr from the Evangelical Environmental Alliance said, look, don't tell my people that scientists are in favor. We've had this thing going with scientists for 100 years since Darwin. And don't tell them that environmentalists are in favor, because we tend to shoot things that environmentalists want to say. So the first message is, who are you talking to? And how do you talk? And the second message is that actually there are a lot of people who don't want the public to understand this. I mean, I was leader of the Conservative MEPs in the European Parliament, but following Margaret Thatcher's lead, I took climate change seriously as an issue. And I think, but there are those who will seek to polarize this and make this a political issue and link it to any particular a political issue that happens to come up. I now teach lobbying. The anti-climate change lobby is the best funded, the most intelligently flexible campaign that humanity has seen in the last 20 years. I regret it. It's they're entitled to do it. I try to speak against it whenever I can, but don't think that it's just that we're not explaining ourselves clearly enough. This is a contest of ideas.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question. I see this gentleman here in the front has had his hand raised.
A question to Durwood Zelke. You mentioned the short-lived greenhouse gases. Could you talk about how quickly those could be addressed through decisive administrative actions? Mm-hmm. Because this is one thing Obama could take to Copenhagen, is that, plus the fact he is already implementing greenhouse gas on carbon through the Clean Air Act and EPA's regulations. So maybe you could talk on both of those angles.
Right. Thanks, Brent. The fast action 50% could be done quickly and produce responses within days to decades in the climate system. It's not just how long the forests stay in the atmosphere, but the governance system that we have available, as you mentioned. And we can do much of this in the old-fashioned way of command and control regulations. This is what the Montreal Protocol does. It says, currently to 96 chemicals, you're unwanted in the universe. Here's your schedule for phase-out. And it's phased out these 96 chemicals by 97% so far. So we could start moving the HFCs, and then we could move perfluorocarbons, which stay in the atmosphere for 50,000 years, so we shouldn't emit them at all. And we could move the FS6, make this a synthetic gas treaty. That could help us a lot. Black carbon, we have regulated for decades for public health purposes. So we have local and regional structures that could take out a major part, probably 50%, very, very quickly, within 5 to 10 years, the predictions by Professor Ramanathan. And the same with tropospheric ozone, which is ground-level smog. We know how to do these things, and we could simply do them better and faster, recognizing the collateral benefits to climate being a tremendous insurance policy that buys us decades of a little more security. Not a lot, but a little more security.
Well, I want to thank everyone for coming today. This has been, I hope for you, an insightful afternoon. I'd say this subject has come a long way since those of us who started working in this area in the early 90s or some even before to really mainstream environmental security into national security intelligence and public policy decision making. So now I'll turn it back to our host, Charlie Ebinger from Brookings. Okay.
Let me thank you all very much for coming. We intend to keep this dialogue going with our friends on the podium and other people in the international community. It was noted that Brookings will have a side event with some of the other organizations represented here at Copenhagen, and we look forward to continued interaction with all of you. Thank you very much.